My name is Yael van der Wouden, and I am the author of The Safekeep.
Dutch writer Yael van der Wouden's debut novel, The Safekeep, is set in a post-World War II Dutch province. It follows Isabel, who lives a solitary life in the home she grew up in, but her world is uprooted when her brother deposits his girlfriend in Isabel's home for safekeeping. Isabel believes items in her house are going missing and is quick to blame her housekeeper and her unwelcome guest. But things grow more complicated from here. I recently spoke with Yael van der Wouden about Isabel's relationship with her brothers, how the post-World War II setting shapes the book, and so much more. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Yael van der Wouden.
It means from the woods. Fan is of, der is the, and Wouden is woods.
So. Oh, interesting.
Of the woods, yeah.
Does your first name have meaning?
Yeah. Mountain goat. My parents are real clowns. El was also a biblical figure who murdered a man with a tent peg. So she lured him into her tent and gave him hot milk. And then when he fell asleep, she took one of the tent pegs and through his temple.
Oh, interesting.
So there's that, but it also means mountain goat. So I'm mountain goat of the woods. My mom's name is much more beautiful because her full name is Avital, which means God's morning dew. And her own last name, Falchi, is flower of the east, or just flower. And so her, my dad's name is Van der Wouden. So her full name, Avital Falchi Van der Wouden, means a God's morning dew on the flower in the woods.
Wow.
I know. And I'm just like mountain goat in the woods.
I love it. Okay, so The Safekeep is hitting bookstores today, and since it's brand new, could you give our listeners a brief overview of the book?
Yes. Okay, so The Safekeep is about Isabel, who lives in her old family home. It's the 1960s Netherlands, and Isabel does not have much going on. Her only joy and her only love in life is this house. She keeps it in order. She keeps everything inside the house in order. And she doesn't have any hobbies. She doesn't have lovers, no friends. It's just her and this house. And then one day her brother shows up with his new girlfriend, Ava, and informs Isabel that Ava will be staying with her for the summer. And that Isabel does not have much to say in the matter because the house is in fact in his name. And so Ava stays for the summer, and Isabel hates this very much. She hates how Ava is everywhere all the time. She hates how Ava sleeps in late, wakes up late, touches everything, is loud, laughs a lot. Really everything that Isabel despises in a person. And so she starts to follow Ava around the house. And there's some issues of control here, obviously. She follows her around. She stares at her from across the room because that's what you do when you despise someone. You stare at them intently for long periods of time. And that's when things start to disappear. So first it's a spoon, and then it's a knife, and then it's a bowl. And Isabel, with her rigid mind, just cannot handle this. And she spirals into an obsession. And that's the first two chapters. And that's all I'm allowed to say. And from there on, it goes off in many different directions.
Why is it, this paranoia, and she has little trust in her life? Why does Isabel cling to these items? And really, they're her mother's items.
Mm-hmm. I think that for Isabel, it's the last thing that she has left. And I think there's also this passage, I think, as if I did not write it. I know that there's this passage, right, where she talks about joy, when she talks about what it means to feel joy and what it means to not feel joy. And she talks about how joy is meaningless because the moment that you feel it, somebody takes it away from you, somebody leaves. And she goes through the list of everybody who's left her, which is really anybody she's ever known, right? Her parents have passed. She has two brothers. Both of them have left her for what she considers, they've chosen love over her. And so she holds on to the things that cannot leave, which is this house, which are the things inside the house and the things that she can control. She cannot control the life around her, but she can control where the spoon goes and where the knife goes. Until, of course, the spoon no longer is where it's supposed to be, and the knife no longer is where it's supposed to be.
I'd like to talk about the sibling relationship between Isabel and her two brothers, Louis and Hendrik. We learn about them through Isabel's lens, getting to know them a bit as adults and then through reflection as adolescents. Talk to me about their sibling dynamic and how the resentment is fueled.
Yes, their dynamic was so interesting to write because it's so unlike my own sibling dynamic. I have two sisters. I'm the oldest, and we're very close friends, and they are incredibly important in my life. And with Isabel and her brothers, I had to write a sibling relationship where, at least with for Hendrik and Isabel, the two youngest one, they are truly sort of they went through their childhood as each other's anchors, and then at one point, Hendrik left the dynamic. He chose something else. And Isabel sees this as the ultimate betrayal, even though the reason why he left, and I will not say too much about this, is because his mother did not accept him. And Isabel saw this as a moment where Hendrik could choose to be something else, could choose to be a version that their mother approved of, and then chose to do something else. And in that, she saw an abandonment of who she was. Because if Hendrik was more like her, then surely, their mother would love him too, and everything could stay the same. But he chose for his own desires, he chose for his own life. And I think there's this question that I was trying to unpack, which is what do we owe each other as siblings, as family members, as people who love each other? How much do we have to let ourselves suffer in order to be there for another person? And what are the limits of that? And what are the expectations of that? And especially, I think in sibling relationships is very interesting because you grow up being each other, especially when it's the three of you, you become a united front, sometimes against your parents. And you stay that way until one of you steps out of that. And it can be really terrifying. It can be really affecting to see the reasons and to come to terms with the fact, like, oh, we are no longer this unit. I used to have this dream that me and my sisters were gonna live in a house together. And of course, right, that never happened. I mean, it shouldn't happen. We would absolutely have destroyed each other. But it is interesting to see the desire, the dreams, and the reasons why we end up having to create our own lives and how we split apart from each other in creating our own lives.
I'd like to talk about the house because it's almost a character in and of itself. You know, although not much of the war is mentioned directly, the book takes place in post-World War II Europe. How did the war affect the house and Isabel's home?
So the way that they end up in this house in the east of the country, because they came from Amsterdam initially. Isabel was born in Amsterdam, and so were her brothers, and they moved to the east during the war. And that was during the war, what happened was that the west of the country ended up being cut off from the rest of the country and also the rest of Europe. And so there was a great famine in parts of the south and the west of the country. And so what a lot of families did was they sent their children to stay with families in the east so that at least the children could be provided for. And that's what Isabel's mother did. She sent her children out to the east and had her brother arrange for a house. And so when Isabel arrives in this house, it is a safe haven, a place where she and her brothers are suddenly alone, right? They're not with their mother, but they do have, suddenly there's food. There's a letter that Isabel writes her mother where she talks about, the cut of meat that they had, which is something that they haven't had in a long time, and the amount of food that they got to have. And so for her, this house becomes a representation of what it means to go from bombs, from war, from danger, from hunger to a safe space. It's also it's this grand house in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of fields. And there's every now and then there's moments of people filtering through, right? People knocking at the door, people walking up the driveway asking for coals. This is still during the war or in the fallout of the war. But these moments are fleeting. So the danger when it comes is only fleeting. And for the rest, the house is a safe space. So overall, the house becomes a place of safety, somewhere where she can borrow away. And she does. And it turns from an event in her childhood to basically her entire life. She does little else but borrow away in the house.
There was a line in the book that was given so much power through repetition. And when I noticed it repeated the first time, I thought it might have been an editing error. But then I read it again and again and again. And the line is, "Once he'd been a child and she had held him through his night terrors." Talk to me about this line and how Isabel believes she is the only one to remember the situation.
Such a good question. Hold on, I'm gonna gather my thoughts. So this, I think, harkens back to the question about the siblings and our relationships to our family, to our siblings, and the way that what we give up for one another. And for Isabel, we talked about her control, and I think this has to do with this as well, right? She had to be the one in control in that moment of place. Louis is older and more distanced from the two youngest. And in that moment, alone in the house, right? The first time that you come across this line, it's when they're in this house and the mother has not yet arrived from Amsterdam. And presumably they're taken care of by either the uncle or the uncle's wife. But no adults are mentioned, and it's just these two children, and there's bombs falling, and they're holding on to each other for dear life. And this is when Isabel holds her brother, and I think you become a version of a parent in a moment like that as the older sibling. And in doing that, you are giving something away, but you're also cementing something like, how to phrase this properly. You become a kind of parent in a moment like that, but also you are cementing your role as somebody who gives protection, but also wants something in return. And that's the agreement that she has with Hendrik, one where she gives him protection and he looks up to her and he is her companion. When he breaks that promise, when he leaves, it is for Isabel. The thing is, I sat with that line so many times, and it was like really, I was doing something very purposeful, and yet now when I have to talk about it, it's like, what was I trying to do? And I do remember, I know what I wanted to do. I wanted to explore sort of what it means to remember your siblings as they were when they were children, when they were babies, what it means to see a sibling grow up while you're not their parent. So it's like seeing your best friend grow up alongside with you. And then when the paths diverge and they go somewhere where you cannot go with them, where you stay behind, especially if you stay behind, and especially if that sibling has chosen what you perceive as another person over you, even though, right, what Hendrik does is he finds love, which is not, it doesn't stand in opposition to Isabel. It is simply the path of his life. But she sees that as you've chosen someone else. And all she has left in that moment is that memory. And also, she's quite bitter about it. She's bitter about the fact that this is the only thing that she has left, and the fact that she's the only one who remembers, the only one who remembers both the wartime as it was in that house, how small Hendrik was. And I think there's also this resentment there toward Hendrik growing up. She remembers him as a baby. How dare he now be a full-grown adult who makes his own decisions? And I think this is their dynamic throughout the whole book, where it shifts back and forth between their friends up until anything is mentioned of their respective lives, either Hendrik's love life or Isabel's potential love life with Johan, the neighbor that won't leave her alone. That's where their dynamic falls apart and they can't talk anymore. Every time either Hendrik's partner is mentioned or Isabel's life at home is mentioned, or the potential of her going doing anything else other than this house, the conversation ends and they go quiet and they don't know what to say to each other anymore.
So Isabel is reckoning with her own sexuality and struggling still to accept her brother Hendrik's sexuality. Talk to me about forbidden love in this time and place.
Forbidden love. Yes. So I've had several times people ask me, like, why the 60s? Why not now? Or why not closer to a different period in time without giving away too many spoilers? And the 60s were, for several reasons. One, 1961 was a full year after the rations ended. So I wanted to start with a year where it felt like there was a potential of access. There is The food is available again. You can do whatever you want. You can go to the city. You can go out dancing. And Isabel does none of that, of course. But also, I wanted to paint a slightly different picture of sexuality at that time, because I think we, especially in the English-speaking world, there's a lot of examples from, let's say, Britain or the United States, where there were a lot stricter laws around homosexuality at the time. And in the Netherlands, there were laws, but they were mostly focused on anyone below 21. And above that, there was no legal repercussion for homosexuality. And so there's nothing on that level that keeps either a Hendrik or Isabel in her own discovery from doing what it is that the fear is not a fear for their lives. There's social convention, there's definitely things that we do not speak of. But it was important for me to make sure that Isabel's repression was internal. Also, this goes the same for her prejudice, for the way that she sees the world around her. I think there are several moments in the book where she acknowledges her own prejudice and preemptively is annoyed with anyone who accuses her of the prejudice, even though she acknowledges the prejudice in that moment itself. What I wanted to do there, I didn't want to give her a get out of jail free card. For both her sexual repression, for her prejudice. I wanted to surround her with the things that she was repressing. I wanted to give her a brother who'd already accepted himself and had already found love. I wanted to surround her with people who are unlike her in every aspect. And so she has the chance of understanding, she has the chance of knowledge, but she still needs to go through a whole journey before she gets to full understanding and full acceptance of herself and others. I think that there's a narrative that gets thrown about a little bit too often for my liking, which is that prejudice comes from a lack of knowledge, that prejudice comes from not knowing the person that you're prejudiced against. And oh, if only you talk to this person, if only sort of you had a friend who was this or that, then that would open your mind. I think sometimes that works like that. But oftentimes, in my own experience, people still hold on to certain thoughts, even if you are incredibly close to them, even if you are one of their best friends. Sexism, homophobia, racism are not things that are cured by knowing a person. They are things that we have to undo ourselves of every single day. And I wanted to show that through Isabel and through her struggles with herself and her own. In many internalized hatreds, I think. Don't know if this quite answered your question. I feel like I went in many different directions, but
No, it's perfect because there's a scene where Isabel, Ava, Hendrik, and his partner Sebastian are in a bar after a day of swimming, and Sebastian goes to order a round of drinks, but he's refused service until he pays ahead, which was not a common practice. Talk to me about this sort of discrimination post-World War II.
So we're entering into the story in 1960s Netherlands, and this is about 15 years after the war. And I wanted to explore the way that the Dutch have dealt or haven't dealt with their own history in the 1960s, mostly because the 10 years after the war were a period of intense rebuild, just recovering from everything. Like I said, it was the first year in 1961 that the rations were called off. And so there was a very sort of big push four words, and especially one that insisted, let's not look backwards yet. Let's not overanalyze what happened during the Holocaust, during the war. Let's not overanalyze our own relationship to otherness. I mean, of course, no one said this out loud, but this was very much them. What I've heard from many people that I've spoken to about it, who've lived through the war, and also many of the interviews that I read. I read this one interview of this woman who reflected on this party in, she went to a party in 1948 or something, or 1946. And during that party, there was like a sad guy in a corner who didn't participate, and she got annoyed. She was just like, we are celebrating our lives, right? We've all survived, we've recovered. And so she went and sat next to him, and she was just like, just have a drink. What, like, just get up, have a drink, dance. And this young man said to her, I can't dance anymore, I can't sing anymore. And she was just like, but we've survived. And he says, my entire family died in the camps. And she describes how her annoyance continues. She's like, well, your whole family died in the camps, but you're here. And this was a non-Jewish woman talking to a Jewish man. And it just struck me very much, this it's not even denial, it's this being completely not ready to move forward. And then once you are ready, you have no desire anymore to inspect or to investigate what has happened. And so you simply don't look back. And so I've tried in, I hope in a gentle and subtle way to investigate different elements of that denial within Dutch culture in 1960s. There's colonialism comes through, racism comes through, sex and homophobia, all through the lens, like you said, all through the lens of Isabel, who is this really isolated and very, very lonely person who doesn't have, right? She doesn't follow the news exactly. She doesn't educate herself. So she only has her own feelings to go by. If she gets a bad feeling when meeting somebody, then that person is probably no good. And she has her mother's sayings that keep on sort of going around in her head, and that's how she makes sense of the world. I think a lot of this also came from my own desire to understand denial and understand the way that we deal or do not deal with histories. What makes it so that we deal with some histories and then completely ignore others?
You mentioned this earlier, but the novel is divided into three parts. How do you define the divisions?
Oh, I okay. This is my favorite thing to talk about, because when I start putting together a story, a novel, for me the most important thing is to figure out what the skeleton is going to be, what the shape of it is going to be, and how it's going to stack together as this structure. My parents come from cinema, from movies. They both worked in film. I grew up watching them storyboard, and I think part of it I internalized to a degree because I storyboard like nothing else. The three-act structure, I think when I first realized that it was going to be the way that it was, the way that I saw it was I wanted to lure the reader in with the first part, making the first part one kind of book. And then when you get to the second part, you realize it's a different kind of book. And then when you get to the third part, it turns into another book yet again. I wanted it to work like a nesting doll of a novel, where you started out with the most obvious version of it, and then you, the deeper you go, the more threads unravel. And I'm also a sucker for a very traditional novel structure. I think that there's a lot of beauty and creativity to be had in these really tried and true methods of how we put together a story.
So in part three, we, through Isabel, read Ava's diary. So the reader learns a lot through revelation, but also there's a shift in point of view from third person limited to first person. Talk to me about how you approached writing in these two styles.
So going from Isabel's voice to Ava's voice was like shedding a straitjacket Isabel was so much fun to write because she gets to say whatever she wants to say. She gets to be incredibly rude at times, also very repressed. But she's a version of me that I would never ever allow. And going from that very restrictive voice, and I had to be so careful writing Isabel that I never gave her too much emotion, that I never spilled over into melodrama, although I sometimes did, and then I had to be called back by my editors, because she needed to be restrained. She needed to be in control of herself. And then to go from that to Ava, which is just, first of all, so many of the diary entries are just complete nonsense, right? They're what diary entries would be. So suddenly I got to be playful again, which I hadn't been able to be for much of the novel. And I wrote most of the diary in two sittings, on the train to Berlin and then on the train back from Berlin. And the train back and forth from Berlin, that's about 6 hours. So I had just 6 hours locked up in a train to basically immerse myself in Ava's voice. At first, it was me having fun. And then it was also me having to put to the test all the research that I did in preparing for this book.
Now, we have talked about a lot. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked?
No, these were already great questions. Listen, so the Dutch of the book has been out in the Netherlands now for a month, and I've been doing the Dutch media circuit, and they only ask about childhood trauma, and then like it's just never about the book. So this was like really a joy to do because I teach creative writing and I teach comparative literature. So talking about the craft of it is my absolute favorite part. So this was great.
The process of reading this novel felt like a slow burn, and you know, the writing was succinct and captivating, even in scenes where there was little action. So, do you find inspiration from other writers?
Oh, of course. I mean, I wrote about this recently that the way that I what I would do as a kid once I came into writing was I would read a novel and then I would try to imitate that novel, thinking that I would be able to somehow do it better. And like I was 14, 13. This is a really overblown ego for somebody that tiny and no experience. But I was sure that every time I read a novel, I was like, yes, this is wonderful. Let me join this. So, I really came into writing through so many writers' voices that I tried out for size. And I'm sure that my writing ends up, because of that, ends up being some kind of, some sort of a quilt of so many styles. And I can't look at my writings and tell you, okay, this came from there, this came from there. It's impossible to trace it back, but I can absolutely tell you that whatever voice I have did not come into existence out of nowhere. It's definitely a melting pot of all the authors that I've grown up reading and then ended up being obsessed over as a preteen or a teenager and then an adult.
Well, the book is The Safe Keep. Yael van der Woude, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth.
That was Yael van der Woude, author of the book The Safe Keep, which was published by Avid Reader Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.